Baby, I really need to talk to you. I really need to know that you're listening. I need to know that you hear my heart.
Hello, NSA. Been feeling lonely in the world today. I got some things been on my mind, and I know that you've been listening. You had my back from 2001. This Patriot Act's been so much fun. People say you're all up in the business, but I need you more in mine. Yeah.
Hello, hello, NSA. How's everybody there doing today? You've been listening for all this time. Can you hear me now?
Baby, can you hear me?
Hello, hello, NSA. Best kept secret in the USA. If you can hear what's in my heart, let me know somehow.
Let your tender software pick up what I'm laying down. Got some little keywords to be our sexy sound. Tell me what to say to really turn you on. Gonna make you wanna tap that line that I'm on. Al-Qaeda.
Ooh, Al-Qaeda.
Militia.
Ooh, militia.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. We start out with The Sixth Extinction. Elizabeth Colbert explores with Steve Curwood the many ways humans are helping to cause the largest extinction event since an asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs. And then after that, the psychology behind morality and politics. When it comes to moral judgments, Jonathan Haidt says, we think we are scientists discovering the truth, when actually we are lawyers arguing for positions we arrived at by other means. Jonathan Haidt is the author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion.
To research her book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert traveled the world to find places where climate change is already having an impact. For her new book, Colbert again packed her bags, but with a different aim, to see how climate change and other impacts of the human race are causing the largest mass extinction since an asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs some 65 million years ago. Elizabeth Colbert says this new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, is in many ways a sequel to her previous one.
I actually went looking for sort of a follow-up, another book on climate change to do, and because I thought climate change, wow, that's, you know, such a huge story. Surely I have not exhausted that story yet. And while I was looking around for that, I really came to the realization that climate change was just part of an even bigger story, which are the many ways in which people are changing the planet on a very grand geological scale that will be essentially, you know, permanent. We're changing the world in ways that geologists of the very distant future will still be able to see that something very, very unusual happened at the moment that for us is the present.
Of course, there's a lot to talk about, but first let's talk about a couple of the other five extinctions before this sixth one that humans are driving. It strikes me that these were all, well, somewhat random.
Yes, I think that's a very important point to make. The worst of all of the what are called the big five of the last half billion years occurred about 250 million years ago. It's known as the end Permian extinction, and it wiped out something like 90% of the species on the planet. And people say, scientists who have studied it say, it came perilously close to wiping out multicellular life altogether and sort of pushing the planet back to the state of having only, you know, unicellular life. The best hypothesis right now is that it was caused by this massive burst of volcanic activity that took place in what is now Siberian and formed a formation known as the Siberian Traps, which is just this huge lava flow that stretches over, you know, thousands and thousands of square miles, and that released a lot of CO2 somehow. It's not even clear exactly how, because it doesn't follow even from this massive burst of volcanism that much CO2 would have been emitted, but a lot of CO2 is emitted into the atmosphere. It warmed the planet very radically, and it acidified the oceans. It changed the chemistry of the oceans very radically. And one of the very sobering parallels, you know, between what we're doing and what happened at the end of the Permian period is we are also emitting massive amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and doing it very, very quickly.
But talk to me about how you see climate change and the burning of fossil fuels as a driver of extinction for marine creatures.
In the case of marine creatures, they are being hit with at least a double whammy. I mean, there are many other forces, as you know, affecting marine life these days. But the big effect of, or two big effects of carbon emissions, one is climate change, which is warming the oceans very, very rapidly, just as it's warming, you know, our land masses. But also, what happens when you emit CO2 into the atmosphere is a lot of it gets dissolved in the oceans. It gets absorbed by the surface layer of the oceans, and it dissolves in the water. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid, carbonic acid. It's a very weak acid, and you drink it when you drink Coke or, you know, club soda. But you pour enough of that into the water, and it's changing the water chemistry.
Now, you went out with some researchers who are looking at the effects of carbon dissolving in the oceans.
Yes. I went out with a guy named Jason Hall Spencer, who had a really interesting revelation one day when he was taken to go swimming in this spot in the Bay of Naples where there are volcanic vents. So there are these vents at the bottom of the sea that are spewing what turns out to be almost pure carbon dioxide into the water and acidifying the water there very much in the same way that we are acidifying the water. And it occurred to him if he could map what lived in that area, you could sort of look forward in time, and as the chemistry changes, what's going to happen to marine life? And so he did this very elaborate census, which required them to spend hours and hours, you know, sitting under the water, counting every, you know, mollusk that was, you know, roaming by. You could see that when you were far away from the vents, several hundred yards away, it was, you know, you could see there were sea urchins and there were sea cucumbers and there were all sorts of seaweed. And then as you got closer and closer to the vents, various things started to drop out. And then when you got right up close to the vents, it was sort of like a lunar landscape. And then there were these sort of unfortunate creatures, these mollusks or limpets that had wandered in, and their shells were starting to dissolve. You could see that they had these pitted shells, in some cases holes in them, because the effect of the water was to actually eat away at their shells.
And this is like a tenth of a decimal point change in the acidity of the ocean there.
Well, so far we have affected a tenth of a decimal point change. We've already done that. And because the pH scale is logarithmic scale, that is represents a 30% increase in acidity already. So since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and if we continue on our present course, then by the end of this century, we will have affected basically a 0.4 change in the pH scale. And that represents a 150% increase in acidity.
Now, we know that the polar regions of the Earth are warming much more quickly than the equatorial areas. You know, the polar bear is that poster animal for climate disruption. But in your book, you note that species in tropical areas, including rainforests, are actually at more risk of extinction. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that, as you point out, the Arctic is warming very, very fast, and that's absolutely true. And, you know, if you're a creature that's dependent, for example, on the Arctic sea ice, which, you know, isn't going to be there quite possibly in the summer and within just a few decades from now, you are quite possibly a creature that's in a lot of trouble. But the fact is that most organisms live in the tropics. The vast majority of species on Earth live in the tropics. And one of the defining characteristics of species that live in the tropics seems to be that you occupy this very narrow range of climate conditions. So, for example, I went to the Andes with a scientist named Miles Silman. And what he had done was laid out these plots of trees where they'd literally counted every tree and identified what species they were from. And these plots ran down a ridge so that each of these plots has a different average annual temperature. And as we were walking down this mountain to look at these plots, he said to me, find a leaf on the forest floor that has an interesting shape and watch it. And you're only going to find this leaf for a couple hundred yards because the range of this whole of the species is so narrow that you can follow it. You know, just as we walk along in, let's say, an hour or a half an hour, you have now gone through the entire range of this species. So these species seem to have very specific climatic conditions that they need. And as we change them, once again, what's going to happen? Presumably some of them are going to move, and he's found that that's the case. Some species are effectively moving upslope, but some are just sitting there. They don't seem to have the ability to move. So we're going to find out what's going to happen to them.
So let's talk about some smaller extinctions for a moment. You note in your book that as early humans settled the Earth, there were pulses of extinction of the large megafauna, you know, the mastodons and the mammoths and the saber-toothed tiger and all that that followed them. You say that we didn't really notice it at the time. Could you tell me the story and what it means?
Sure. Until relatively recently on Earth, on all the different continents, there had been these huge, huge animals, which now on several continents you didn't find anymore. You didn't find them anymore in North America. You didn't find them in South America. In Australia, you had these enormous marsupials, which are known colloquially as rhinoceros wombats. You didn't find those anymore. They also in Australia had these giant tortoises that you didn't find anymore. And what seems to be pretty clear from the evidence now is that the pattern and the timing does track when humans arrived in a continent.
And so what did we do as humans?
The prevailing theory right now is that we simply hunted them. What large animals tend to share, certainly large mammals, is that they have a very low reproductive rate. So you don't have to depress their numbers very much. You don't have to cut into that reproductive rate very much before you start to see their numbers decline. So being very large and slow to reproduce is a really good strategy if you don't have any predators. You've escaped predation. You're so big and fierce that you don't have any predators. But as soon as you have a predator, like a human, who can hunt something larger than itself, which is quite remarkable in evolutionary history, then your numbers can start to slide. And over many hundreds of years, you know, it didn't happen right away, but over hundreds of years of hunting pressure, they simply went extinct. And so, as you suggested before, people didn't realize that was happening as it was going on, but it seems pretty clear that people were responsible.
By the way, in Africa, the region where the modern humans evolved, we still have large animals like elephants and rhinos and big cats. Coincidence?
There's certainly a hypothesis that perhaps in Africa, having co-evolved, as I say, not just with modern humans, but with our early tool-making, you know, pre-modern human ancestors, that they did evolve the appropriate defenses, and so were not as vulnerable to us.
Amphibians actually predate the dinosaurs, but they seem to now be the class of animals most at risk for extinction, I read in your book. Can you explain more why?
What seems to be a big killer in the case of amphibians is a fungal disease that was presumably moved around the world by people somehow, because it popped up very quickly in very disparate places, in South America, in Central America, in Australia. So it seems that it must have been something that was moved around the world. And one theory, which is intriguing, is back in the 50s, there was a frog called the African clawed frog that was used for pregnancy tests, and many of them were exported from Africa. And what happens is if you inject an African clawed frog with the urine of a woman who's pregnant, then a female African clawed frog will lay eggs pretty quickly thereafter. So it was a pregnancy test. And those frogs were moved all around the world, and they seemed to carry this fungus, but not to be affected by it themselves. So one possibility is that that is the way this fungus was moved around the world.
Now, many people listening to us are, of course, very concerned about the notion of extinction. But some people will say, hey, you know, extinction is just part of nature. Why should we be so worried?
Well, extinction is part of nature, once again, if you're taking, you know, the very, very long view of things. But extinction at the rate that we're seeing it is not. And it means if things are going extinct faster than new species are being created, which is, you know, evidently the case right now, it means that the variety and diversity of the Earth is shrinking.
I imagine reporting this book had to be a lot of fun at times. I mean, you were in the rainforest in Peru, you're down in the Great Barrier Reef, you're all over Europe. So along the way, what signs of hope did you find?
Well, I met a lot of people who are incredibly dedicated to trying to save, you know, what's left of the natural world. And that is a very hopeful thing. I mean, people are really concerned about endangered species, but we're these very mixed creatures. You know, on the one hand, we do really care about the creatures that with whom we share the planet. And on the other hand, without really intending to, we are very good at changing the world in ways that make it very difficult for them.
Elizabeth Colbert's new book is called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Thanks so much for taking the time with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Where everybody's just waiting for the fall outside the green zone through the machine gun turrets on the other side of the wall.
Clive and Bundy's cattle, moo, moo, mooch. We love to listen to him prattle, moo, moo, mooch. It's all about the freedom to graze on public greens. Yeah, we're a food stamp stampede of welfare Dairy Queens. So whatever Clive and says, well, that'll be what we'll be saying too. He's free, and so are we, 'cause he's as free as how everything ought to be. And he's loading up for a big old range war. Yeah, he's a big freeloader, that's for sure. He called for a posse, and now we got us a posse comitatus. We're Clive and Bundy's cattle, moo, moo, mooch. We'll follow him right into battle, and we'll put the women and the children up in front. We strategize. He says he won't acknowledge that the government exists, and we say right on, Clive, and then we pump our hooven fists. Yeah, whatever Clive and says, well, that'll be what we'll be saying too. Booze, moos, spread the news of his views. Our moos, that's who's. Hannity, Van Susteren, Greg Abbott, Rand Paul, Dean Heller, Rick Perry, Ted Cruz. Clive and Bundy's cattle. Said Negroes were better off as chattel. Moo, moo, whoa. And now we're trying to skedaddle, but our hides already tanned. 'Cause high-fiving, slave-driving, cliving is the new Republican.
As a special holiday treat, we now present a frightening story that will haunt you and your children for years to come. To help tell this morose tale, as Frankenstein, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. In the role of Igor, please welcome President George W. Bush. And as the bride of Frankenstein, Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I was working in my office late one night when my eyes beheld a Wall Street fright. Lots of bad loans that were risky debts were crumbling just like the New York Mets.
They needed cash.
They needed monster cash.
They needed cash.
We needed it in a flash.
Taxpayers' cash.
Taxpayers' teeth will gnash.
They sound brash.
But we need monster cash.
We've seen the housing bubble burst when Congress got involved and went from bad to worst. If I'd run the Titanic when it's submersed, I'd have yelled bankers and brokers first.
They need some cash.
There'll be a monster clash.
Over this cash.
We need it in a flash.
We want the cash.
If we don't get this cash,
without that cash,
there'll be a monster crash.
I've studied history and I'm telling you, we beat the Big Depression 'cause of World War II. So now a new solution has occurred to me. I'm about to end this crisis, we start World War III. Or
we'll we get some cash.
Cash, good. Yeah.
time comes and everybody wonders, will tomorrow bring the light of day? Will our house be rubble blown asunder? In the cellar we will hide ourselves and pray. Will the smoke clear in the morning? Will the city all go down in flames? Will the factory be standing? Will life here ever be the same? There's terror in the skies of this city. Fear is in the hearts of children, women, and men. And you never see the faces of the killers as the smart bombs fall again. Will there be a job for me to go to? Will there be food upon my plate? After so many years of hungry sanctions, what did my child do to earn this fate? There's terror in the skies of this city. Fear is in the hearts of children, women, and men. And you never see the faces of the killers as the smart bombs fall again. Talk of Gaza and of Algiers. They wring their hands when Irish shoppers die. But if you want to know a life of terror, look up at night into the Baghdad sky. There's terror in the skies of this city. Fear is in the hearts of children, women, and men. And you never see the faces of the killers as the smart bombs fall again.
And now for something completely different.